the power to interpret this event in a certain way can be important for a whole range of different things, the immigration debate, the gun control debate, American foreign policy.
The journalistic analysis of the Boston bombings is most revealing, as Rorschach tests often are. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The alleged bomber, we're told, has cited the Al-Qaeda magazine Inspire as the source of inspiration for the pressure cooker bombs. One reporter says, maybe, maybe not.
I don't know what it is, but for some reason, this magazine just seems to bring out the worst in reporting.
Also, a veteran launches a satirical blog, which turns out to do some seriously good work.
I've gotten messages from guys that say, you know, I have PTSD, and this is the only thing that makes me laugh. And I get those messages, and I'm just blown away.
All that plus fixing Twitter after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week's bombings at the Boston Marathon were about alienation.
The narrative that's taking shape around the Sarnaya brothers is one of a couple of guys who sort of alienated from their local mosque, who more or less self-radicalized and looked stuff up on the internet.
No, that isn't right. The murder of three innocents and the grievous injury to hundreds were an object lesson on immigration.
These are individuals that are coming from a part of the world that keeps feeding into this terrorist network. There is no right to come into the United States. It's something we allow people to do. There's no right.
No, that's wrong too. The latest incident of terrorism on U.S. soil was all about lapses in security.
The FBI's handling of Tamerlan Tsarnaev in 2011 and his six-month trip to Russia the following year now face congressional scrutiny.
Well, as they say, a hammer thinks everything is a nail. The interpretations of last week's terrifying events, as aired across the media, depended entirely on the agenda of whoever was doing the interpreting. In our polarized, polemicized political environment, scarcely an event takes place that isn't claimed by various advocates as the smoking pressure cooker of their various dire fears. But if some reactions to the bombing news were particular, one, in the nerve-wracking hours before the suspects were identified, seemed universal. On everyone's mind was the question, what would be the identity of the culprits? Not the names, the identity. What group would they belong to? Would they be Muslims? Would they be white? Would they be foreigners? Would they be Americans? And sure enough, when Tamerlan and Jakar Tsarnaev were finally named, the answer to those questions, in all cases, was yes. Peter Beinart wrote about the identity factor in the Daily Beast. Peter, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you believe that the subtext of race was so prevalent?
Well, I think we have this binary kind of division in terms of thinking about these kinds of acts, which in the media is basically Islamist, jihadist terrorists on the one hand, or crazy white Americans on the other. And as I was thinking about that kind of opposition, which kind of played itself out in a lot of different ways in the media, it occurred to me that there has been a way in which Islam has been racialized in the American conversation so that it's the opposite of white. What turned out to be interesting about these guys, the Tsarnaev brothers, who come from the Caucasus, which is the place from which we derive the word Caucasian, is that it just exposes that that makes no sense.
How did the word Muslim come to be so all-embracing as a dangerous other?
Well, I actually found the historical material really interesting. You know, of course, for most of American history, the government had to figure out what race you were, even though race itself, of course, is a social construct. But the government had to decide what race you were because we were a society segregated along racial lines by law, and often your ability to gain citizenship depended on whether you were classified as being white or not. And so you see these series of cases in the first half of the 20th century where people from the Middle East are trying to prove that they're white. And what you find is that the courts start suggesting that Christians from the Middle East have a better claim than do Muslims from the Middle East, because they start to wrap the idea of Islam in with the idea of not being white in a series of cases starting from 1915 and continuing to 1942. And I think that's the backdrop that was kind of in some ways activated after 9/11, this kind of history in the United States of seeing Muslim as something that defined you as not white.
It turns out that in answering the question you posed, you found a Rorschach test within a Rorschach test, because various parties took a look at the Tsarnaev brothers and said, aha!
Well, there was this interesting case study in this, because this writer at Salon, David Sirota, wrote a piece before we knew who had committed the attacks, saying, I hope these are white Americans. The argument was that there would be less of a crackdown on civil liberties if it was a Timothy McVeigh-style character than if it was a, you know, people like the 9/11 hijackers. And then when it turned out to be the Tsarnaev brothers, and we realized they were Muslim and that there might have been some connection to Al-Qaeda-like ideology, some people said, aha, you see, David Sirota was wrong. And that's what I found so fascinating about this, that there was actually this real life test which exposed the way, perhaps semi-consciously, people see white and Muslim as alternatives.
We heard Marco Rubio looking at this as an immigration matter. David Remnick of The New Yorker just kind of assumed that the Tsarnaevs were acting out of reaction to the repression of Chechens. Fox News has made political hay out of the fact that the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was on welfare.
I think on the right, there is a pre-existing view that we remain in this war on terror with this external foe, and this fits into that. I think progressives are more interested to see this as an immigration story, and that makes it in some ways more of a story about us, about issues that have emerged inside the United States with difficulties of adjusting to being American.
You know the story of the three blind men and the elephant?
Yes.
And they each touch a different part of the elephant and then describe it all differently? Is that what's happening here?
Absolutely. There's a recognition that the power to interpret this event in a certain way can be important for a whole range of different things, the immigration debate, the gun control debate, American foreign policy. And so people are trying to do that. It's understandable, but it's also sad in many ways, because I think that, honestly, an event like this is in many ways also just very sui generis. To try to draw too many conclusions about what's right and wrong in American society, or even the nature of the jihadist terrorist threat from this one incident, I think is dangerous. You need many, 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 many more data points, I think, to really be able to tell that story.
Peter, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Peter Beinart writes for The Daily Beast. Pressure cookers? In the aftermath of the Boston bombings, the media and everyone else marveled at the use of cookware to create mayhem. But the explanation was quickly forthcoming. Not once, but twice, the instructions for building such a device have been published in Inspire, the English-language magazine of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. On Tuesday, NBC quoted law enforcement sources as confirming that Jakar Tsarnaev, from his hospital bed, credited Inspire for his lethal inspiration. Sounds plausible. Except, we've been down this road before and never quite gone in the right direction. J.M. Berger is an editor of IntelWire.com, and he wrote about the facts and fictions of Inspire for ForeignPolicy.com. He says that even before founder Samir Khan was killed in Yemen, along with fellow American firebrand Anwar al-Awlaki in a Predator drone strike, Inspire had been both inflated in significance and snickered at as a laughingstock.
The snickering, I think, actually, it's appropriate in some ways, because the magazine had a lot of content that was, frankly, ridiculous. They proposed that people weld lawnmower blades to a truck and drive it into a crowd. Its most recent issue proposed that people rub cooking oil on highways in order to cause traffic accidents. I mean, there was a lot of ridiculous content in it. At the same time, it was always something to look at and be concerned about, but what happened when it first came out and continued throughout its history is that the media coverage on Inspire has been just wildly inaccurate and kind of overblown. So it became an easy punchline because the quality of the product was not really all that good. and the way that U.S. officials and journalists were talking about it was extremely dramatic.
What constitutes quality in a terrorism motivational magazine?
The same things that constitute quality in any magazine. So, for instance, the first issue after Khan's death featured a gigantic typo on the cover. They were trying to say that they were winning on the ground. That was the banner headline, winning on the ground. And instead, they left out one of the N's, so it said whining on the ground.
What did we, the media as an institution, get wrong over and over and over?
From the beginning of the coverage on this, and I'm not really sure how to explain it, because people who otherwise did very good work just didn't seem to be able to wrap their heads around this concept. The Atlantic's website, for instance, had a detailed analysis of the article by somebody who hadn't opened the file because he was afraid there was a virus in it, which there wasn't. NPR reported that it was printed on glossy paper. It never had a print component. It was always on a PDF. For some reason, these kinds of ideas just entered into circulation, and they've really continued up until today. Mark Mazzetti, a New York Times reporter, has a new book out on the CIA, and he describes Inspire as having been read by Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood gunman, and Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, but both of those guys did their attacks before Inspire even existed. I don't know what it is, but for some reason, this magazine just seems to bring out the worst in reporting.
You're explicitly not saying we should pay no attention to Inspire magazine.
Well, I have never said that we shouldn't pay attention to it. The issue with how we talk about it is that when people are radicalizing, they get their information from watching television and reading newspapers. And so when they're in that process of radicalizing, we sort of created a much bigger audience for this publication than it necessarily had to have.
And we're making that worse right this minute, are we not?
Well, it's over now. Going forward, they're going to claim, regardless of the veracity of whether these guys used Inspire in a significant way to build their bomb, Inspire is going to claim credit for this attack, and we're going to see a huge increase in its credibility because of that.
So if I understand this correctly, the press kind of got it wrong from the very beginning, has repeatedly mischaracterized the magazine, credited it for things that it could not possibly have influenced, and so forth. But now, whatever mistakes were made in the past, it is very much a part of the ecosystem. A lot of wannabes are going to go there now because it's now famous for inspiring the Tsarnaevs.
Just the reporting of this Inspire claim, you know, based on very thin sourcing and without a lot of qualifications is already, that's all Inspire needs to make hay out of this. The very likely next step in this process is going to be that Inspire will release an issue commemorating the bombing. The only real question is how much credit they're going to assume for it and how much they're going to use it to trumpet their own position.
All right, J.M. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
J.M. Berger is an editor of IntelWire.com. Coming up, struck by the speedy ID of the Boston Marathon suspects using surveillance video? Just you wait. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Shutterstock.com, a global image marketplace on the web. Shutterstock.com helps creative people find images or videos for their next creative project. Shutterstock offers a collection of over 20 million high-resolution stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, and is searchable by subject, emotion, and other features. Any image in any size is available for one price. For a free trial and a special offer for our listeners, go to Shutterstock.com/PRI. On the Media is supported by Air France, the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European capital of culture. A major attraction of the Provence region are the beaches of Nice and Cannes, which are known for sunbathing, discos, high-end shopping, and restaurants, whereas Antibes and the Cap d'Antibes, about halfway between Nice and Cannes, offer a quieter beach vacation. Tickets and information on daily flights to Nice and Marseille are available at airfrance.us.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Surveillance camera images of Tamerlan and Jakhar Tsarnaev catalyzed not only the manhunt, which caught them, but calls for more surveillance cameras around the country. The usual suspects took their usual sides on the issue. Law enforcement speaking security versus privacy advocates speaking privacy. But it's worth remembering that right now, video surveillance is a blunt tool. Technology is racing forward toward capabilities that will make today's surveillance methods, and the privacy fears attached to them, seem almost quaint. Christoph Bregler is a professor of computer science at New York University. His lab has received military and commercial funding to create the surveillance tools of the future. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the main thing separating whatever tomorrow's technology is from today's is searchability.
That's correct. Right now you can search any text with Google and find it right away, but you cannot do the same thing on video yet. So we're working on making that searchable in a similar way.
I'm trying to imagine a zillion cameras deployed and the cops or the CIA or the Army being able to figure out exactly where I've been, who I've been with, and what I was doing, you know, with a mouse click.
Yes. So that was actually the initial goal already over 10 years ago. And we've been working on using face recognition, but also intrinsic biometrics. In simple terms is when you look 20 blocks down the street, even you cannot recognize a face. If this is your friend, you can recognize, oh, this is exactly the motion pattern of Uncle Freddy.
You mean his gait, his pattern of walking, his posture?
Right. His timing, his gestures, his body language. I myself, I'm from Germany, and when I'm in New York and I see a German tourist 20 blocks away, I can tell this is exactly an Italian tourist or a German tourist, even without...
Wait. You have Germandar?
Yes, I have. And we actually showed that computers can do that too. We can detect national background. Our technique can do this with 80% accuracy. We combine that with sound spectrum of how the people are speaking, the height of the person. We are getting to very, very small error rates.
Chris, I want to ask you about the Boston Marathon bombings. Police eventually located suspects by combing through a lot of surveillance camera footage, actually not government surveillance cameras, but private ones, I think attached to a Lord & Taylor store where they finally made their positive ID. How would that investigation change in the future that you're envisioning?
If you look at any kind of attack, there's always enough information there. It's just a problem. People couldn't connect it fast enough. What we're working on is to narrow down out of millions of videos down to like the top 100 events. And then a security specialist can go in there and then decide, yes, this is suspicious and this is not suspicious. So for example, we know that 2 hours before the event, there was an entire bus of tourists coming out and positioned themselves at a certain corner, and we can track them and can rule out this set of people is less suspicious. And then whoever is left over is marked red. The most important thing is we can do this instantly.
Well, it's easy to see why law enforcement would be champing at the bit to get a hold of these tools. And it's also easy to see why privacy advocates are frantic, because you're describing the security state. You're describing Big Brother. The abuse of this kind of technology seems to be almost unavoidable. How worried should we be?
Definitely we should be worried, because the police has access to a lot of surveillance of video cameras. And right now, the technology is not there yet to allow them to actually process all the video. All the agencies are right now overwhelmed with too much data they cannot process. And I would even speculate right now that through crowdsourcing and the internet, all the citizens all together are faster than government agencies right now in processing it. We're all little brothers to the Big Brother, and we actually have much more power than we expected.
Nonetheless, we are envisioning a government who could, if they wished to and could get away with it, routinely follow us around, which just seems so grossly not the American way. What do you anticipate will happen once this technology is unleashed?
We just have to get used to it, that we're less private citizens. We will most likely act differently in public places because we know in advance, if I'm out in the public, sitting in a cafe, I know whatever I do, somebody will track it. And so we might change our behavior.
Because the government is watching. And
the government and everybody else.
Chris, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Christoph Bregler is a professor of computer science at New York University. Last week, of course, brought a deluge of news, and we struggled to keep up with it, let alone weigh in. So we asked for your help. Our first question, what kind of coverage would you like to see of breaking news? Dozens of you commented on our site, and you were very clear. Pat from Maryland wrote a kind of summation of many of the other comments, quote, all I want are factual updates when there is a new development. What I don't want is days or weeks of continuous wallowing in grief, microphones and cameras in the faces and lives of the victims and survivors, and endless speculation about causes, perpetrators, and how this changes everything. By Friday, when we asked you what you thought of the ongoing coverage of the Boston bombing, you said you were frustrated with cable news, and we're instead turning to the most immediate fount of information, Twitter. Lee from New York City wrote, quote, it's unfolding as we speak. The media is trying to keep up, but Twitter is an outstanding source for this. Let's not forget, a lot of news on Twitter is from the news media. Kevin Bonham of Cambridge, Massachusetts, had a slightly different perspective. He wrote to say that his media consumption on Friday was directly affected by the manhunt in his backyard. Quote, mostly this morning, I'm just watching Netflix. I'm on news overload and feel like I can't trust the real-time reporting from anywhere. Plus, waking up expecting to go to work and then being told that I'm on lockdown is just too surreal. I need some escapism. And finally, we asked you what you think the media missed last week. You ready? The short list includes, but is not limited to, the trial of the former president of Guatemala, a report on the U.S. use of torture after September 11th, the Keystone XL pipeline, the trial of Philadelphia abortion doctor Kermit Gosnell, and New Zealand's passage of a gay marriage bill. Worthy topics, one and all. Now we will behave the way most news organizations do when they miss important stories. We will act as if the events never occurred. But thanks for the suggestions. Keep them coming to onthemedia.org. And don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. The story broke in early 2011.
Five U.S. soldiers stand accused of shocking crimes that include murdering Afghans for sport.
In 2010, a group of American soldiers stationed in Afghanistan's Kandahar province formed what they called the Kill Team, the team's goals being to murder Afghan civilians and cover up the crimes by planting weapons on the corpses. The infantrymen also posed for grisly photos and videos of their victims, and the team leader cut off fingers as war trophies. They killed three unarmed Afghan civilians, one a 15-year-old boy, before they were caught, convicted at court-martial, and sentenced to terms ranging from 9 months in prison to life. Now a documentary about the crimes, featuring astonishing confessions from the principals, sheds real light on the case and on the barbarism of war. Dan Krause directed the documentary The Kill Team. His window into the story was a series of press reports about a young soldier said to be a whistleblower. But Private Justin Stoner was not only not the soldier in his platoon trying to stop the killings, he made clear to Krause that the outing of the Kill Team was an unforgivable betrayal.
After speaking with Stoner in the production of this film, I learned that he very much disavows that characterization. And in fact, he is deeply regretful that he had anything to do with the incarceration of his fellow soldiers. He, in his mind, has violated the highest moral priority of an infantryman, which is he has betrayed his fellow soldiers.
I never want to be referred to as a whistleblower, as it's worse than what they're being portrayed as. If I could go back, I wouldn't have said anything.
And furthermore, what he revealed, at least initially, had nothing to do with the murder of civilians, but in fact, drug use by his platoon members in his tent, which just annoyed him.
Right. He came back from mission and detected the smell of marijuana in his room and became irate and reported that to a superior, which in turn filtered right back down to the platoon, and they gathered and quickly decided to beat him up. And the investigation into that beating was ultimately what led investigators to discover the crimes.
Ironically, though, there had been a previous whistleblower, in fact, of the atrocities, who, through his dad, had tried to alert the army to what was going on. But that soldier, Adam Winfield, and his dad failed to penetrate the army bureaucracy.
That's right. Adam Winfield reached out to his father through Facebook because he was afraid to speak with his father by telephone for fear that the other soldiers would overhear him. So he asked his father for help and advice. And together, they decided to alert the military through back channels. And Christopher Winfield, back home in Florida, started calling everyone he could think of. Army investigators in Washington, he called the Army chaplain's office at Fort Lewis. He even called his U.S. senator in Florida to no avail. He eventually got hold of a duty officer at Fort Lewis who informed him that unless someone came forward with a similar story, there was nothing he could do. And so Chris had a decision to make. How far was he going to take this in order to get someone's attention? If he continued pushing it, the question he asked himself is, will I get my son killed? And he told me it was the most difficult decision he's ever had to make in his life. They decided that the best strategy would be for Adam to keep his head down, to lay low, to stay away from the other members of the kill team, and to come home so that he could report the crimes to investigators afterward. But before that could happen, a murder occurred right in front of him, and Adam was forced to decide whether or not in that moment he was going to stand up to prevent the murder from happening or whether he would go along with it, try to come back from the war in one piece.
Tell me about Adam Winfield.
Well, Adam Winfield was a specialist in the platoon, and when the first murder occurred, he was deeply troubled.
He was afraid, first of all, that if he went through the chain of command, it would come right back down to his platoon leader, a sergeant named Calvin Gibbs, who was the ringleader of the kill team, who had threatened him with violence, and Winfield had very good reason to think that his life was in danger.
Yes, as soon as Adam voiced any misgivings about these crimes, he immediately started receiving threats from the other soldiers directly to his face, and he knew that they were serious. He knew that they didn't want to spend the rest of their life in prison and would do what they had to do to make sure that didn't happen.
Perhaps what's most astonishing about this film is the tape you gathered of these guys telling you everything.
Yes, they were anything but mindless grunts. These were young men that had an astonishing degree of articulateness and reflection on their crimes and, in a broader way, their role as soldiers in this war. And it was hard not to be, in some cases, even charmed by them. I couldn't reconcile the experience of sitting in the room with these young guys with the photographs they had made. For instance, in Corporal Morlock's case, the photograph of him holding up a 15-year-old boy's head.
The film's narrative follows the legal case of Specialist Adam Winfield, who was the would-be whistleblower. It's also the subject of a lot of moral ambiguity because he was, on one hand, trying to stop the kill team from murder, but was also a participant.
And that was exactly what drew me to the story. When I first read the description of Adam Winfield, it described him as both a whistleblower and a murder suspect. And immediately, I was drawn to understand how that could be. How could these two moral poles exist in one person? What had happened? Adam claims that he aimed his weapon away from the victim and fired off into the air. But what's clear is that he did not stop the murder from happening. And that's indeed what he was ultimately charged with, involuntary manslaughter, for not preventing Sergeant Gibbs and Corporal Morlock from proceeding with the murder. Adam fully accepts responsibility and has a deep remorse for not doing more.
Among the questions raised by the film and not answered is the question of institutional culpability, on the part of the army. And the other issue that seems unresolved is how much of an outlier this is. There's a scene at the end which is positively chilling.
Everything we did was put into the media as we're horrible, we're the kill team, we're rogue platoon, we're all these things. I don't care what the military wants to say, but this goes on more than just us. We're just the ones that got caught.
So that's Private Stoner justifying the murders as standard operating procedure.
I would caution against any presumption that this is widespread. But what I would say, and this is what I've heard anecdotally from all the soldiers I've spoken with, is that it certainly happens more than people know. I think there is an institutional question related to these crimes, that it is larger than the soldiers themselves. This is the paradox of the military, that the military functions effectively when there is this deep cohesion among all the soldiers. But that cohesion also prevents soldiers from stepping outside of the group and questioning the moral direction that it's taking. I think what makes it so difficult to be a whistleblower in the military is that the loyalty that soldiers feel to one another overpowers any other moral impulse. These sorts of atrocities date back to the Greek Wars, to the Bible. I mean, anyone who reads Homer will tell you about war crimes. And so to dismiss this as the actions of a few bad apples is to ignore the larger questions that these incidents provoke.
I came away from this feeling ambiguously about many aspects of the issues at hand. What was your wish as a filmmaker for me to come away with?
I would like audiences to recognize that when we as a nation commit our troops to war, we are certainly asking a sacrifice in terms of money and of blood. But what we don't think as much about is the moral sacrifice that we're asking our troops to make and the moral sacrifice that we as a nation are making. There's a new term that psychiatrists are now using to describe a type of psychological injury from the theater of war, which is called a moral injury. Very different than PTSD. A moral injury is the result of either having taken an action or not having taken an action that violates their own moral code. This is something that more and more soldiers are describing. These injuries are not only incredibly destructive in the moment, these injuries haunt soldiers because they're forced to replay their decision in their mind over and over again.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan Krause is the director of The Kill Team, which is currently on the festival circuit. On Thursday, it won the Best Documentary Feature at the Tribeca Film Festival. We'll link to more information about the film on our website. Coming up, say what you wish about military intelligence, but military humor is not an oxymoron. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we just heard from filmmaker Dan Krause, moral injury is one thing veterans can bring back with them in the sometimes uncomfortable adaptation back to civilian life. Indeed, such anguishing burdens, yielding tales of alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, and crushing boredom, have become fixtures, if not quite cliches, of reporting on vets. Reporter Quill Lawrence naturally covers those issues on NPR's one-year-old Veterans Beat. But having himself been deployed for many years in Afghanistan and Iraq as a war correspondent, Lawrence believed he owed vets a more dimensionalized portrayal. Thus, he has fought his own assumptions and conventional wisdom to seek stories with unexpected conclusions, such as when he went to the UK Paralympics last summer.
I went over to London with this preconceived story in my head about, you know, American veterans knocking up competition a notch. And I found out that no one needs to teach Paralympians about competition. And the vets, they fit right in as really competitive guys. We ended up following this Navy unexploded ordnance operator who'd been blinded in a bomb blast in Afghanistan.
One of the harder aspects of my injury was not necessarily the physical detriment, but it's the idea that I got benched. I was on an assault team doing operations in Afghanistan, and in a snap of a finger, I was benched, and I wasn't able to be with my team anymore. But to be able to go back out and throw on this uniform, wear my flag on my sleeve, and compete for Team USA, I used the term earlier, get back into the fight.
He was an extremely competitive guy, was swimming several events on the anniversary of his injury in Afghanistan, but all of these other Paralympians were every bit as competitive. And so that was a surprising story as well.
You did a very compelling piece about Hurricane Sandy and the efforts made there by vets in an extraordinarily chaotic environment. How did that all take place?
Well, I'm based in New York now, so I got pulled into the Sandy coverage by virtue of the fact that I lived in Lower Manhattan and had no power, so I could sort of cover out my front door. But within a couple of days, my beat had sort of run into that story as well, and there was a group called Team Rubicon, which had sent a bunch of very capable, very enthusiastic vets out to the Rockaways in Queens, one of the areas most severely hit by the storm. And these vets were out there, and they were mucking out basements and chainsawing down trees. Some of them had set up camp in a church, and it looked just like places I'd embedded with troops in combat, with their bedrolls on the floor and everything very well organized. And these veterans were telling me that in many ways what they miss about being over there is this sense of purpose.
I knew I was missing something. You know, I took different contract jobs. I was in school. But there was just the applied, the working with a, you know, working with a group of individuals that you could trust at all times, whose actions you could just predict.
When they come back, it's hard for them ever to feel that sense of mission again. But doing these sort of charity missions, especially where they can get dirty and work under these rough conditions and help people out, it sort of brought back a little bit of what they'd been missing.
You know, one is always struck in an airport when you see someone approaching a soldier in fatigues and saying, thank you for your service. Does our interest in the returning vets go beyond the hug in the airport, or do we feel as a society that we've, by acknowledging them, we've just done our part?
Yeah, I've heard it referred to as sort of a yellow ribbon fever thing. You just stick the decal on your truck, it says support the troops, and that's all you really need to do. I was wondering when we started this beat, and I've only been on it for less than a year, I was wondering what was going to happen when that stated commitment to support troops ran into the tough economy. And some veterans advocates groups are already sort of sounding alarm bells. They saw last year, even during political season, that some veterans assistance bills were killed in Congress, and there didn't seem to be any consequences. So people were really worried that the enthusiasm for helping these vets is already waning.
It's been many decades since the returning veteran was such an enormous demographic. I mean, it's a large number of people. As you pull back, what's the biggest story attached to this population?
What I'm waiting for is the 10 years down the road story. I think about you're going to be living, some of these young guys, for 40, 50 years with recurring health problems from this. So I'm wondering how that's going to work. I'm also wondering what the effect will be as the national discussions turn to what these wars really meant, with a consensus among so many analysts about how little these wars achieved. I'm wondering how veterans are going to square that conversation with what they've sacrificed.
Quill, thank you so much.
Sure thing. Take care.
Quill Lawrence covers the Veterans Beat for NPR. Sensitive, responsible journalism is, of course, a very good way to serve the interests of a given population. Another way is insensitive, wholly irresponsible clowning around. After all, even soldiers, especially soldiers, like to laugh at the foibles of the military.
General Westmoreland went to see the president. I guess it didn't work out. He's back.
That's Bob Hope entertaining troops in Vietnam in 1967. Comedians like Louis C.K. still take USO tours to war zones, but for those on active duty and those who have re-entered civilian life, there is a new source of satire, the Duffel Blog, an Onion-style online publication that allows current and former military to satirize military life. Here's a Duffel Blog headline for you, quote, "Decorated war hero, airborne ranger emasculated by wife at local mall." Or how about this one? Quote, "Coast Guard finally shoots something." Or this, "Bill O'Reilly wounded in latest salvo of war on Christmas." The site scored an Onion-esque achievement when it fooled the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, with the headline, "Guantanamo prisoners to receive GI Bill benefits." McConnell's office fired off a sharply worded letter to the Pentagon before realizing it had been punked. Paul Zoldra, an 8-year Marine veteran who served in Afghanistan, is the site's founder.
Humor in the military is something that really keeps a lot of people alive and keeps them able to continue on the mission.
You mean like Russians during communism?
Yeah, exactly. I don't like the analogy of, U.S. troops to communists, but I take your point.
You've gotten a lot of attention, notably in the Wall Street Journal, for the Mitch McConnell episode. Someone in his office didn't understand that they were reading a satirical piece. Does that happen a lot? Do you get other blowback from people who are just irony impaired?
Every day we get to look in the comments section and see someone that did not get it, and, you know, we all get a laugh, and then ultimately, we cry for humanity. But other notable people, we've gotten Gizmodo before. We've had other politicians besides McConnell. And really, it doesn't matter to me whether they're Democrat or Republican. I just think it's really funny that our site can fool you. Because if you really read it and you're, you know, thinking critically, you would see it for what it is, which is obvious satire. But some of the stories really play into political biases that people want to believe. And, you know, that plays out pretty well in the comments section.
Now, there's one very funny headline that caused you just a world of hurt. And we're going to have to do some beeping here. But the headline reads as follows. "Senator clarifies remark telling troops to go f*** themselves," says, quote, "taken out of context." Tell me the story.
Oh, man. So I the politician thing to do, you even saw it with McConnell, is to deflect. They say something stupid, and then instead of saying, oh, you know, I screwed up, they say something like, oh, well, that was taken out of context. And so I wrote this piece with the senator in mind.
The politician was Senator Linda Lopez.
Yeah, state senator. After the Gabby Gifford shooting, she was on Fox News, and she actually said, without any information, she said that he was probably a Afghanistan veteran. Basically, you know, perpetuating the myth that the crazed PTSD veteran shot up a congresswoman, which we know, of course, you know, was not true. He had no military connection. So fresh in my mind, I wrote this piece and had her saying outlandish things like what you just referenced in the headline and many, many more things that anyone that read this would clearly see, like, okay, this is pushing the boundary. Like, no, maybe they'll say he was an Afghanistan veteran, but they would never say what was in this piece. And that one went viral, and then it went through Twitter. We had, I believe, Adam Baldwin tweeted it out to his fans. Radio host Dana Loesch actually mentioned it on her show, and she believed it. It was one of those things that, like, you look at and you go, man, that really escalated quickly.
I guess it's a coup of a certain sort when someone prominent is hoodwinked into thinking that a satirical piece is actually serious reporting. I wonder about the larger coup of actually triggering policy discussions with stories that shed light, however satiric, on something within the military. Have you had any success there?
Not that I know of, but I think with satire, that's always the goal. I mean, you always have some sort of target. You know, a great example is the suicide issue in the military is a really big problem. I had a friend, a Marine, his name's Corporal Seth Smith, got out of the Marine Corps. 6-7 months later, ended up committing suicide. It was very hard. But I wrote a story that was basically saying that military members were committing suicide during suicide prevention briefs. And the whole idea was that the system as it is now, most of it is a lot of check in the box and, you know, just send people to a PowerPoint presentation and they're trained and now they're resilient to suicide. And that's not the case. And so we were shedding light on that. We're making fun of it. And, you know, my hope with that is that down the line, maybe some Army general, one in particular we made fun of pretty hard in that story, maybe he'll read that and he'll be like, yeah, you know what, they're kind of right here. You know, that's a lofty goal. I don't know if it'll happen, but, you know, that's what it is.
Do you have any aspirations to revisit a more serious look at the issues that the society is facing? Or does, in a funny way, the Duffel Blog actually do that job for you?
I mean, ultimately, I'd like to get back to, you know, helping veterans transition. But I think in our own weird, twisted way, the Duffel Blog has kind of done that for us. I've gotten messages from guys that say, you know, I have PTSD and this is the only thing that makes me laugh. And I get those messages and I'm just blown away. I'm like, oh my God, this funny blog that I kind of just started on the side is helping people cope with their issues from war. I mean, that's huge for me. So I think we're doing that. I think we're you know, supporting the troops, if you will, with humor, just like Bob Hope did or just like Louis C.K. does. And I think we're just one aspect of what needs to happen. I mean, there's plenty of, you know, therapy and there's things on the VA side that needs to be fixed. But I think we're just one small piece of that puzzle.
Is this a business? Labor of love? What?
It's both. It's been a labor of love for a long time. It's not providing me crazy amounts of money right now, but it's been one of those, you know, just kind of keep doing it because I've been doing it for so long. And I don't want to let those guys and girls that in Afghanistan or elsewhere, I don't want to let them down.
All right, Paul. Semper Fi.
Semper Fidelis. Thank you.
Paul Zoldra is the founder and editor-in-chief of The Duffel Blog. Oh, and by the way, here is a clip of Louis C.K., entertaining the troops.
I was in England recently. You know what I like about England? They have money that's like a coin. Like the pound is a coin. It's not a bill like a dollar. I like that. I like spending a coin. It's like the old West. You know, you go into a saloon, give me a glass of beer and a bottle of whiskey and a room for a week and a steak dinner and a shave, a haircut and a bath, a woman, some oats from a horse, and then just pang, that's all. One shitty coin and you're fine.
Bamboozled by online scoops, Mitch McConnell, you are not alone. In the past 2 weeks, a lot of people have been seriously misled by what they've read, many of them via the magic of Twitter. In the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings, journalists and civilians alike rapidly passed along unconfirmed details and rumor, leading to a pernicious circle of retweeted misinformation. Innocent people were misidentified as suspects. A fake Twitter account, purportedly belonging to one of the bombers, was reported on Twitter as legit. And for Twitter, things went from bad to worse. On Tuesday of this week, the Associated Press's Twitter account was hacked. The hackers posted a false tweet about two explosions at the White House. And even though that was quickly corrected, the financial markets swung wildly downward in response. All this has led to a conversation, can we fix Twitter? We put our producer PJ Vogt on the case. PJ, we're not the only ones mulling this over. What's being said out there?
Matt Honan at Wired wrote a piece this week where he said that basically what Twitter needs is a corrections function. So the way he envisioned it, if I were to tweet, Bob Garfield is dead, and a bunch of people retweeted that because that's a huge news story, and later I found out that, in fact, I was wrong and you were alive, I'd be able to go back to my original tweet, write a little correction at the bottom of it, and not only would it show up on my feed, but everywhere that my tweet went, it would show up as well. I think it's a great idea. I don't think it would ever work because it seems like it would be so easy to abuse. You could tweet something, it could go viral, and then you could add on like a spammy link. And also, it just seems sort of aesthetically clunky in this way that I don't think Twitter really likes.
But there are other ideas out there.
Brooke had this idea to put a question mark at the beginning and end of every tweet. That way you could signal to your readers that this was information that you weren't sure was true. She mentioned it to Andy Carvin during their live chat a while back.
A question mark at the beginning and a question mark at the end could easily become part of the Twitter lexicon and wouldn't get shorn off.
Why not?
When copied, because it's only a character.
But it's stuff like that gets shorn off all the time. That's the problem.
As Andy pointed out, first of all, people might just get rid of the question marks when they retweet it. Secondly, it doesn't address the main problem we have now, which is that people tweet information that seems good at the time and then later find out that there's something wrong with it.
But you have a genius idea.
So my brilliant plan is just that if I tweet something and I find out that it wasn't right or that it was half right or whatever, there should be a way for me to flag it. I'd click a button and my tweet and every retweet of it would turn red or be grayed out. Something that just says, there's something fishy here. And the reason I like it is because it's simple, it's not easy to abuse, and it sort of puts the onus back on the reader. They now need to go out and find what really happened rather than relying on this piece of information.
And because it's fishy, it would come to be known as a red herring. This would be like a term of art for Twitter users worldwide, invented right here.
Right. The funny thing is, when we talk about changing this, it seems impossible, and it's like this beautiful thing that kind of works, and it'll never be any different. But everything that is part of the grammar of how we use Twitter, retweets, hashtags, at replies, none of those came in the box. Those are all things that users wanted to exist, and so they created it, and eventually the service officially recognized it and incorporated it into their architecture.
Well, I've declared this a genius idea, but the fact is, I'm not sure. Are you sure?
No, I'm not sure. I bet that there is something dumb about my idea that I can't see because it's my idea. But I also bet that our listeners have a better one. So I was hoping we could just throw it open to them.
Uh-huh. Well, that is a genius idea. PJ, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, listeners, this is our time. We can fix Twitter. Leave your best suggestions for how to make Twitter better at correcting bad information and more accurate for breaking news delivery. Just go to our website, onthemedia.org, to leave your suggestion, and we are going to solve this thing. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alexandra Hall. And our show was edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ian Turner. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.